it was amazing to look at the psychological barriers that people put up in place that were going to prevent optimized decision making. Insurers use concepts like loss optimization algorithms all the time to pick out key investment decisions and initiatives that will give you the biggest bang for buck across a policy. That concept should be applied in the way we think about technology change, and any change really for that matter.
From Exabeam, this is the new CISO, a show about the people who lead IT security teams, the challenges they face, and how they overcome them. If you like what you hear, please rate, review, and subscribe to hear our new episodes first. I'm Steve Moore, and today I have the privilege of speaking with Ash Hunt, Global CISO of Apex Group. We'll revisit Ash's career beginnings in episode 2, but first we're diving into the challenging and risky world of M&A. As a CISO, one of the world's largest fund administrators, Ash offers his key insights on loss, risk, and revenue generation in a constantly changing IT environment. Outdated but industry-wide psychological barriers can limit a cybersecurity leader's ability to problem solve. So where does loss actually occur, and how do you quantify it? What's the definition of secure, and what did jaywalking and cybersecurity have in common? Ash, thank you so much for making the show today. If you would, for the uninitiated, who are you and what do you do?
Yeah, good to be with you. My name's Ash Hunt. I'm currently the Global Chief Information Security Officer for Apex Group. So I've spent most of my career in defense or cybersecurity in one form or another. Apex Group is a really exciting organization. We're one of the world's largest fund administrators and alternative asset managers in the world. We've got over $3 trillion in assets under administration and management. And we're really leaning into a kind of fintech space now with a really comprehensive product set that spans everything from depository banking, fund management, private equity, hedge, and all the way through to blockchain offerings. So very exciting business that's rapidly growing. We've got about 12,500 people in the organization today in 40 countries and in very much in the merger and acquisition space. So very exciting from a security standpoint and a technology standpoint to be part of a really fast moving organization.
It sounds that way. I mean, 40 countries, there's a lot that goes into that from a technical perspective, but also culturally. What's acceptable from a security standpoint, privacy, what's allowed. You probably stay very busy also on the audit and compliance front.
For sure. I think I'm quite blessed as a CISO. I've got 7 functions that report to me, and they span everything from traditional in-house security operations, but right through to what I would call sort of pan-technology disciplines. So I look after all technology assurance activities. So you've just alluded to a couple there. Traditional technology audit, governance, third-party assurance, compliance, regulatory adherence, and all those exciting things. But then also through to technical operations. So all identity and privileged access management in terms of like control design sits under my area as well. Indeed, any kind of security engineering. So it's great because I get to have my team is more importantly get to have pretty pervasive influence on the material changes that we make in technology. But it's also great exposure because, as you said, it can be really challenging navigating a global landscape where regulatory obligations and privacy requirements differ dramatically, right from very small island jurisdictions where we operate in, right through to large nation states with very mature and robust governance requirements. So one of the approaches though that we take, which has been particularly beneficial to navigate that, is really trying to embed the most stringent requirements from our global regulatory authorities as our minimum baseline. And what that's done is helped establish an extremely robust posture for those smaller jurisdictions and entities where they don't perhaps have as much national scrutiny or regulatory scrutiny, and has then pushed us forward, particularly above our competitors in the marketplace, in building a very firm security posture that's really not just about, you know, locking down the doors and ensuring that everyone's operations are sealed tight all the time. It's really about actually driving and enabling operational efficiency so that people can operate anywhere at any time, accessing whatever they should be accessing seamlessly, and really opening up as much revenue generating opportunity for the business as possible.
You mentioned growth from M&A. To me, that's one of the two or three kind of pillars that I've seen that can cause the most risk for an organization, either when it's not dealt at the front side of the M&A in terms of assuming risk, or maybe worse, is living with these inconsistencies long term, which creates lots of sort of trash and we call sort of tech debt that lives in your environment and doesn't allow you to have these sorts of seamless bits of IT and security cleanliness and sort of widespread access that we would want to have. Just because it's one of my pet peeves, sort of bad M&A, either on the front side or the long-term consequence, share with us a little bit of your opinion or your philosophy around that, of how to do it well, because I know many others either inherited bad M&A or in the midst of it today.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I've seen throughout my career. Even when I was working in big banking, I was part of a very significant billion-dollar acquisition. And I think probably that, I don't know, necessarily jaded my view, but it definitely taught me a lot of lessons learned of how not to do things as much as how to approach things in the right way. You'll hear industry colleagues wax lyrical about shift left, and they're 100% right. In my former CISO role, I was working very much with Exco almost prior to deals. So technology assurance was a consideration even in the overall prospect and offering of purchasing and acquiring a business. And that's absolutely how it should be, because I've dealt with several examples, including businesses that have been impacted by very serious cyber attacks for purchase, whereby we then inherit that. And that becomes a massive problem, well, as a lot of what you've just spoken about, right? The tech debt that you kind of inherit. And it's not just about traditional security, as people might be thinking of. I think they think of risk really in this space in often the wrong way. When I look at a lot of the things that impact the wider group business in the either today or in the experiences that I've had in the past, the way I look at, well, risk is holistically across all technology. I'm only concerned with loss exposure across any part of the technology estate. I think cyber risk and information risk is almost a misnomer. I think it's an extremely unhelpful overcategorization. And so when I look at these unintegrated estates, a lot of the loss that they then kind of contribute in terms of increasing our exposure to as group are things like operational inefficiencies, lots of duplicative application instances, which never get rationalized. It breaks in infrastructure processes where if an incident's discovered, or actually if an incident arises, it's not being centrally managed as quickly as it should be. These small things kind of metastasize the more businesses you acquire. And invariably, a lot of the time, the businesses that you're acquiring are going to have, this is not always the case, actually, it's just perhaps in our case, a much more reduced IT estate in terms of digital footprint. They've got smaller technology ecosystems and typically much less mature control environments. So wrapping them under group is obviously really valuable. But I think one of the exercises that I try to get my teams to do to try and go after the biggest bang for buck across that technology debt is to look at things end to end. So I'm really lucky that I have a very close working relationship with the chief technology officer and the chief data officer. We act as a sort of triad in terms of our strategic initiatives. And we place a lot of emphasis on, and have done over the last 18 months and will continue to do so, on sort of infrastructure integration, application integration, because that actually is solving where most of our loss is occurring. And invariably, when you do that, building that new secure strategic environment with secure by design principles, it's actually going to solve most of the traditional information security challenges anyway. This could be things like building better resiliency, standing up a new sort of operating environment for end users. It could be, again, ensuring that our applications are more robust by migrating operations teams onto a single application instance rather than having 14 different versions, all of which need to be patched at different times, etc. So those are just a couple of examples that feed into a common theme of really trying to tackle this from an end-to-end technology perspective and not looking at it I certainly don't look at it as a CISO just from this kind of security or privacy angle. You know, I always find it really funny that we talk about CIA and security constantly, okay, which is a really useful paradigm. But like A is forgotten about in almost every instance. People obsess about confidentiality breaches, and rightly so in many cases. But when you actually look at what harms a business continuously over long protracted periods of time, and particularly that has client-facing impact for us at least, is service availability. You know, we have like risks of capital call notices if key applications are offline for a certain period of time. And M&A can feed very heavily into augmenting that problem if you don't work out an integration strategy and a kind of pipeline process of helping bring those businesses in. And the other key point to that you mentioned, Steve, is culture, right? People don't want to be left in island, you know, a kind of archipelago of small satellite states across a group business. They want to feel they're part and parcel of one common brand, one common operating model. And that's something that we think integration through technology can really help deliver.
It's interesting. You said a lot there, and it's all fantastic. You mentioned CIA and people sort of forgetting the A. I think as an adjunct to that, we often also forget about performance and efficacy. And maybe even we talk a lot about innovation, but not enough about remediation of, as exciting as it is to innovate, I think in many cases, we'd be better off to clean up the trash in our environments. We'd have a better initial ROI for certain, but thinking about just things that are sloppy or slow or don't make sense, whether it's patching landscape or duplicate processes or just more things that you have to protect. The other point that I very much resonates with me, I'll say, is I don't know how many M&A situations I've been a part of where, in my prior role, where they say, okay, make this secure. And I said, no, just adopt, you know, pick an email environment, pick the domain infrastructure, just adopt what we've already built. And then it's, by virtue of that, it's secure. I get very tired and frankly bored of being told to make it secure. We have environments that we've already vetted. Just move them onto those. And then my job is almost zero.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point. I do a lot of talking on risk, and whenever I talk to people about it, I try to make these analogies to your personal risk appetite on a day-to-day basis. Like I use jaywalking as a great example. In London, it's hyper common. Everyone does it. You're very, very familiar with the environment. You get used to the traffic speeds and frequencies. And, you know, you adapt to that environment. If you're hit by a car tomorrow, you're going to check your risk appetite will change dramatically. You're going to become more cautious. And then when you map that back into the way we execute technology change, you're absolutely right. I loathe the term secure. I think it puts in people's heads this finite threshold that once you get to it, then what? You know, you're good. Well, that's never going to be the case. No one would ever agree to that. It really needs to be more of I try to build in a set of design principles that are the sort of baseline expectations for build or for operations in our environment. But beyond that, the threshold of what's quote unquote secure changes depending on user groups. It can change depending on operational activities. It can change depending on the technology I've got available. It depends on, you know, how aggressive the business wants to be in pursuing a particular objective. The only way you have no risk is for the business to do nothing, okay? When you go after and achieve strategic objectives as an organization, you will always invariably incur forms of loss, whether it's through inefficiency, whether it's through, material incidents, whatever it might be. And we have a finite pot of resources to invest that cash in initiatives that will mitigate as much of that exposure to loss as possible. And some of those initiatives are smarter and more beneficial than others. And I think people look at that whole problem completely in the wrong way. Secure to me is helping this business to sustainably grow and achieve as much money and revenue generation as possible.
You've brought up exposure of loss or forms of loss. And I really like that sort of phrase when thinking about security, well, maybe even larger than security. And I've heard you mention a couple different examples of these forms of loss that I think go beyond what most CISOs or most security people in general would talk about. You've mentioned about inefficiency and sort of duplicate systems. I'll throw in an example, but then I'd like for you to kind of build on that a little bit more, just of what is the full scope according to Ash, because I think it's a thing that's worth talking about and expanding and maybe even debating industry-wide. And one example, we had an outside firm managing our data center in my past life, and you know, we're sort of paying for the ping power pipe and these things, these servers to be racked. And through the process of incident response, inevitably, we would find systems that we've told them to sort of shut them off and retire them, but they're still running because they're still getting paid. And so the joke was that I kept a running list of how many systems and how many dollars we saved accidentally by finding systems that should have been retired. And then I would report this number on, you know, as I would report up. And it made people very uncomfortable, but it was a beautiful conversation to sort of say, look what we're, and it's a very sort of clunky version of inefficiency, but it's still this sort of a form of loss that's outside of security, but is still sort of security sort of finding and managing this. This is probably outside of your example, but I wanted to frame it up to maybe either get you excited or get you to dismiss or sort of build on that idea. Could maybe walk through your take on that example and then maybe share your other forms of loss that you like to think about.
Yeah, I'm sad like that. I do get excited by things like this. and it's a great example. I think I have a different view because one of my functions is technology, risk, decision science, and control architecture. And, you know, I've chosen those labels for very specific reasons because I think risk management, again, invariably becomes this tick box exercise where people want to, it's a compliance exercise, right? Where they just want to be seen to be doing something. And I say to people all the time, the whole purpose of what you would call risk management is decision management. It's to execute decision analytics in a smart manner that will drive investment decisions. And investment decisions doesn't necessarily mean like a whole CapEx spend on a new product. It's literally the time per hour of each of my staff doing things. And ensuring that's directed in the right direction. And so your example is brilliant because I think reporting up is a really great concept. I think I try to tell people all the time that in my head, at least, loss and revenue generation are two sides of a seesaw. As you reduce loss exposure, you're opening up revenue generating opportunity of a quantified amount, because you can literally model out that if you weren't going to experience the incidents that you either have experienced on a certain frequency or basis, or forecasted to, then the business is getting back that quantified amount of opportunity that it wouldn't have had otherwise. And I think that's probably a discussion for another time, because there's a lot of detail in the modeling analysis around that. But it's something I've spent years looking at. And I know I've got a handful of really close industry colleagues very much involved in the kind of quantitative risk space who think about those same problems. But this concept of decision management is really everything to me. Decision science is everything that I try to drive in my approach to doing any part of security. And I'll use one example that I think hits on one of the themes you mentioned, which is decomming, right? It's just such a commonly overlooked area. So as someone in M&A, I've got a huge tool stack. If you look at the whole group, right, probably 35, 40 point solutions. And I'm on a massive consolidation exercise down to sort of 6 or 7, right? Enterprise grade end-to-end technologies. But as you go through and do that, God, you don't have centralized contract management or license management in a nice clean SAP instance. I then get hit with renewals out of nowhere and don't have time to get the product out and the new product in and all of these kinds of things that then start ballooning my budget. And there was a great example of this where we were deploying Netskope this year. So we're building out a SASE architecture across Apex, which is a fantastic capability that we've got in Netskope and covering a huge amount of control capability for our complex multi-cloud estate. And we had a legacy product in there. I won't name names, I'm sure most listeners can probably guess, but it was a legacy sort of CASB. I think it was doing some URL filtering and a couple of other things and some proxying. But this product had been in the business for I think over a decade. Contracts hadn't been reviewed and visibility was almost non-existent. And we're about 3 months into deploying Netskope, and we're probably about halfway through the timeline, but on track. Suddenly, we get this renewal quote for another 12 months of this vendor product, and it was something like $500,000, right? And I was like, well, there's no way we're obviously going to pay that. The new replacement, right, is going to be the control remediation, if you want to think of it like that, is going to be embedded within a month or two. But equally, because visibility is so poor, it's a very difficult judgment call to make on, am I going to be comfortable with allowing a control gap for that period of time, right? And we could be talking a couple of months, right, which is plenty of opportunity for multiple incidents. And so I went to the teams and said, look, what would it take to expedite the Netskope deployment? And the great thing about Netskope is it's in one agent. So it was really just about that deployment. And the response I got back immediately from multiple teams, and this really speaks to the psychology around decision management, is can't be done. Can't be done. We've not got enough resources to do it. It cannot be done. And I said, okay. So I walked them through these thought exercises and said, look, imagine you could have anything you ever asked for. Tell me what it would take to deliver this deployment within 2 weeks. And they said, eventually, it took a long time, but eventually we got there and said, okay, well, we're probably going to need a couple of engineers of this type of caliber. They're probably going to need, I don't know, 36 hours a week dedicated to this solely, and a series of emergency change requests opened up. And then we also looked at forecasting a X percentage increase rate of incident tickets post-deployment in a hypercare period, whereby obviously a rushed deployment would cause probably some configuration error here and there. And so I started quantifying the cost of those engineers per hour and the operational time per hour it would cost to mitigate the fallout in the hypercare period. And my calculations came out at between $60,000 and $95,000. And I had this $500,000 renewal. And I presented the business case to Exco and said, there is no such thing in life as the luxury of doing something with no loss, with no downside. Even if you don't want to materially capture it and define it, it'll exist in some way, right? Everything's got a cost to it. Every benefit initiative has got a cost to it, right? And I said, but look here, I can save you sort of $450,000, and we actually will increase benefit. And we did some quantified stats around that as well, because we will have actually deployed Netskope months ahead of time, even with hypercare. And lo and behold, we did it. And nothing went disastrously wrong. Things did go, you know, there were incident tickets, there were issues, of course there were, but there was nothing in there that no one had experienced before. There was no, what people like to call these sort of black swan events, right? Which are never really black swan events, but you know, it's all common stuff the engineers had dealt with before. But it was amazing to look at the psychological barriers that people put up in place that were going to prevent optimized decision-making. Insurers use concepts like loss optimization algorithms all the time to pick out key investment decisions and initiatives that will give you the biggest bang for buck across a policy. That concept should be applied in the way we think about technology change, and any change really for that matter. We have our, I call them bean counters of hours for each of our staff members, and we've all got skills and we've got programs of work. But we should be thinking about decision management in those terms of where can we best spend the finite amount of resource that we've got in order to get the biggest return for the smallest amount of effort. And I think that's, for me, I use that example all the time. I just think it's powerful, probably more on the psychology than on the actual engineering change.
Yes. Yeah, I was going to say that. And there's sort of this organizational psychology or organizational norms that form over time in all companies of all sizes where something is impossible or no, we can't do that. And it's funny how many companies are willing to live with difficult migrations, difficult support schedules, outages even, but they're not willing to push forward sort of positive change. They're reluctant for that, but they're willing to accept sort of all the other trash I mentioned. And it philosophically, I think, is very interesting how often we're stuck on that. And for me, one of the examples I think of often is the amount of work and trash cleanup that happens during incident or breach response, especially breach response, because what's gone there? The thing that's gone is you operate very quickly. Again, if it's a major breach, all of the governors are sort of gone. Right? You fly, you move, and you get things done. You implement new technologies, either to support the response and understanding sort of scoping of the issue, the remediation event, or the sort of the response action associated with removing the adversary, or sort of doing this hyperfix type work you're talking about, where your 3-year plan or 1-year plan gets accelerated into like 60 days or 30 days or 20 days or whatever it might be, right? Which is what you're talking. It was self-imposed due to bad license management, but the same thing, the net-net is the same. And so the decision-making is what's important. And you either add value or you don't. And that's the other thing. There's a lot of people who are left in breach response, or in this example, with their hands in their pockets. And, well, why am I not involved? Why am I not? Because you're not needed. We've gone around the process that you govern, that you gatekeep, because it's not helpful right now. And I find that, I love that for so many reasons. I'm just sort of reminiscing a bit, but I think that it's an interesting, you know, what would you do if you could do anything was kind of the question you asked, which is applicable not only to risk reduction and managing loss, but also, frankly, life.
Well, if someone said to me at the moment, what's the biggest initiative I've got going in security, it would be my CTO strategy of integrating the business into a single, you know, operating environment by end of year, integrating all those unintegrated entities. That is hands down my biggest security initiative. Why? Because it's going to rationalize my tool stacks. It'll clean up my budget. It will remediate all of the infrastructure misconfiguration that those estates have carried with them into it. It means I've got much more stringent, when I say control, I don't mean locking it down necessarily, but much more governance over the secure strategic environment, right? It's one single place that I can look at. It means when I'm deploying conditional access policies or any form of secure baseline configuration, it's standardized, it's uniform, there's one Active Directory. The benefits are huge. People have a very, I think, from my experience in security, a very, I don't want to sound horrible, but it's sort of like unjustified view of really where their loss occurs. I think lots of people, due to like research forums and the perception generated across industry, that, oh, most loss occurs from attacks. And for some businesses, that's absolutely true if you've got that kind of threat landscape. But for lots of businesses, and I mean a vast majority, lots of the loss exposure that is incurred is through operational inefficiency, access control failure, and inadvertent data disclosure. I guarantee it. I've seen it multiple times, and I've got industry colleagues in the modeling arena with myself who have been in large financial services, manufacturing, logistics, insurance, and it's the same repeatable message. And I think a lot of that comes down to, again, decision management, about looking at things in through the lens of what actually is going to deliver the biggest value, right? The biggest bang for buck. So it's definitely the way that I try to look at things. But back to your point, right, it is a cultural change. I think the technology industry has a long way to go. I think it will. You'll see this step change over the next half a decade, whereby we need to rapidly increase our ingestion of sound scientific practice from other disciplines into the way that we operate technology, particularly in enterprise environments. And there is actually almost an inverse scale that as organizations grow in size and complexity, decision optimization decreases. I say to people all the time, the best businesses in the world at managing risk are small businesses. Why? They can't afford not to be. They will literally disappear and collapse and go into administration if they don't manage risk appropriately. You start building cushions, protective cushions, over time as your business becomes so large that you can avoid some of the things that would fail a smaller business. But even big businesses, right? There's obviously hundreds of examples, collapse if they get things wrong. But in terms of true like cost management, I think it's such an interesting concept. I just think there's loads of money to be saved and value add to be provided that's like locked at the moment, and that we have the actual capability to unlock it, but probably not the right thought leadership and maybe support to actually do it. And I think that's one of the cultural drives that I try to drive with senior businesses across senior leaders across my business. But I'm very fortunate in that, you know, the exco and my colleagues in the technology leadership are all very much behind that kind of approach.
One of the things, I used to say, especially during M&A, is that you can count on me to have a mission to build great capabilities, to build relevant capabilities that distinguish us from our industry peers. What I need more than anything else is for all of us collectively to track the adoption of those things. And those will be built not as a silo, but as part of, as you're mentioning, sort of the larger infrastructure. But I'm going to build things that will differentiate us from our industry peers. But the greater amount of work is tracking the adoption of it, whether that's through cleanup, whether that's through retiring of domains or different onboarding techniques or whatever that is, that's these sort of good hygiene or you know, risk reduction exercises. And this goes back a long while. People always thought that my statements were a little strange because they're like, well, don't you care if everyone is secure? And I'm like, the better way to fix the problem is to build the centralized asset or have the thinking behind, understand the adversary, understand our risk, and then let me put me on point for that. And then let's utilize things like automation and adoption of technology and good M&A, good business decisions to sort of fix the rest of it. And it's amazing how strange that was when received by many of sort of legacy IT people and IT security people.
Yeah, I think the adoption piece that you mentioned is spot on. I'll use a great example. In fund administration, it's very common for lots of the operational processes, including transaction processes, to take place via email. Obviously, a lot of the time you're dealing with maybe sometimes family offices or small wealth management organizations, and really the MS suite is all they've got. But we obviously have a vast technology stack, not only in what I would call run the bank technology, which is like our day-to-day infrastructure ops, but technology that we actually either buy off the shelf and reconfigure for our clients, or indeed technology we actually develop ourselves and sell to clients. And there's lots of instances where we've discovered over the last year or so where we've made a diverse offering to our clients to say, you can actually, instead of, for example, using email, you can go through a portal, or you can exchange data maybe via Snowflake or something like this. And you would think that everyone would jump to that. And I guess there are instances where costs differentiate. But when you actually look at the adoption, it's amazing how so many people are still defaulting to email. And then you think, well, no matter how well good the intent is of a risk mitigation strategy or control remediation strategy, which is that we would reduce data type events and incidents by pushing people through portals or direct data exchange rather than email, it's completely irrelevant if you don't embed that culture of adoption or that kind of persuasive influence with internal stakeholders and external stakeholders that this should be our SOP, this should be our standard operating procedure as a business. And that's what I find as a truism, even of the technology operation and security controls that we deploy in the business. Coverage is so important. I'd rather have a very thin baseline, at least as an established posture, and then I can pick and choose to your point, right? Whether you go from an asset-centric point of view or whatever, to go after the biggest areas of loss exposure, rather than saying, I've got this shiny tool, but it's actually only doing 10%. It's very, very difficult to manage that kind of thing in an enterprise environment, and very difficult to justify as well to boards and, you know, excos and the like when things go wrong. Whereas actually, it's a much easier conversation to say, look, we've made a strategic investment. This is the deployment coverage, and these are the areas we prioritize going after based on robust analysis and modeling. And then if something happens outside of that, you can be like, well, look, we just didn't have the resource to cover that. And every piece of analysis showed that was something that we didn't need, you know, it wasn't a high priority for us. I've had such easier conversations with auditors and regulators because I've had that analytical sort of set of artifacts to fall back on that justified my decision management, as opposed to, you know, a couple of colors in a risk matrix and a finger in the air hoping for the best.
Right. A red, yellow, green box.
Yeah, the famous traffic light scoring, which is the bane of my existence.
Well, hey, I'm going to, just for the listener, I'm going to take a, first off, thank you for all of what you shared so far. We're going to take a very short break and come back and actually talk a little bit about the beginnings of Ash, going back to probably some jazz. And then I want to jump back into this idea, which I love, around losses greater than a breach, which you enumerated. So for the first part, thank you so much, Ash.
Cheers. Thanks, Steve.
That is it for this episode of the new CISO. Thank you for listening. Check out more episodes on exabeam.com/podcast. Remember to rate, review, and subscribe to get brand new episodes first.